I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hello, I'm Adam Levy, and this is Working Scientist, a Nature Careers podcast. In today's episode, moving labs abroad. In this series, we're answering the question of how to move labs. We've already looked into how to choose a lab, as well as the questions around moving when you're not just considering yourself, but your relationship too. And coming up later in this six-part series, we're looking at the challenges of moving labs with a disability, dealing with switching disciplines, and moving around while in the midst of a pandemic. In today's episode, though, we're taking a look at a giant leap that can be equal parts overwhelming and rewarding, moving to a lab abroad. What opportunities can changing country open up, and what challenges does it present? I spoke with three researchers about their experiences, positive and negative, to give you a sense of the impact these changes can bring on you as a scientist, as well as on research as a whole. One easy stumbling block is language, not necessarily vocabulary and grammar, but those much harder to define cultural norms that go into our communication. Missing these cues is something that Ali Bahmani has occasionally struggled with. You see, Ali grew up and initially worked in Iran, but he's now a PhD student in electrical engineering at the University of Gävle in Sweden, where he works on digital twins and distributed systems. He moved to Sweden with his wife, an urban planner who is retraining so that she can apply these skills in the Swedish context. I caught up with Ali and asked how the two of them ended up in Northern Europe.
When I have graduated at the master level, I joined to the industry in Iran, and I had, I think, more than 7 years of experience of working in the industry in Iran. But after that, all of these 7 years, I like to enroll to the PhD and continue my education. And after that, I found some university in Sweden.
Were you at all nervous about the possibility of moving from Iran to Sweden?
At least in the academic level, we have some differences between them. But one thing which I realized was that mostly the Swedish people that they are working in the academy, they are shy people, and they are very polite, because they never say that this work is very bad. They never say these things. I think when my supervisor said that, okay, this work is good, and then some good words, and then finally say, but we need to do something. And then I realized that, oh my God, this work is not good. Because when the Swedish people say, but at the end of their sentences. But I realized it after 1 year, and then I found that, okay, I need to work with this kind of the culture with them.
So how would it be in Iran then? How would someone give you negative feedback in Iran?
In Iran, most of the people are very astride, and then when they want to say no, this is not good, directly say to you, this is not good at all. And then they asked, for example, my supervisor at the master level, he asked me to re-implement one simulation more than 10 times.
Were there some things that you found, I suppose, more positive and more interesting about the differences between Iran and Sweden?
In Sweden, I think most of the people, they work individually and they're very calm. And at the end, you can get a good result, better than Iran, because I think it's happening in Sweden and for my PhD studies, because I remember that I have a kind of the challenging for implementing a kind of the indoor positioning system with a wireless nodes. But I had to implement this thing over kind of the hardware. But the hardware, I couldn't get a good result. But every week I came back to my supervisor and said, yeah, I have these difficulties and I couldn't solve it. And he said, be calm. Finally, you can solve it. And I continued until I think it takes 1 year. But finally, I could get a good result over that one. But I think in Iran we got a full of stress to do something in the industry, because we're responsible to answer to the project manager and so on.
Do you feel like the Swedish people that are around you in your society have been welcoming and accepting, or have you faced any issues at all as someone arriving in Sweden from Iran?
I think so. They are very welcome, and the Swedish people, their attitude regarding to the Iranian people, it's positive. I think so. Because right now we have a two minister in the government that they are Iranian people that moved so many years ago in Sweden, and they have this attitude even on the Iranian people, and they are very helping us to growing up in the new countries.
Can you imagine staying in Sweden and Sweden being your new, I suppose, permanent home? Or do you see your future research going back to Iran?
This is the most important question that so many times I'm thinking about it. We have some kind of the opportunities to apply to go to the other countries, not even in the European countries, in the United States and also in the Canada and Australia. But I think Sweden is one of the best countries for doing the research, and also one of the best countries for living and get the advantages for the whole life. So me and my wife, we decided to stay here in Sweden for the rest of our life. But for part of the time, maybe we are going to do a research at the other countries, but we want to come back here.
That was Ali Bahmani. So it's clear that Ali sees his move abroad as permanent. And of course, many other researchers are in the same position. But for others, changing countries when changing labs can feel more complicated. Sarah Suleiman is now an assistant professor at the University of California, San Francisco, where she's researching immunology of infectious diseases, specifically tuberculosis. Sarah has written about her experiences for Scientific African magazine in a piece titled On Science and Homecoming, A Diaspora African's View. She explained to me that her path to California from Saudi Arabia, where she grew up, had many stops along the way.
All right, let's do this. So I was born in Sudan. And then when I was 2 years old, my family decided to move to Saudi Arabia. So I grew up there. So that's two. And then moved to Canada for my undergrad and grad school, because I already had family members there. So that's three. And then I moved to South Africa. That's four. And then to the States. But even within the States, I lived in two different places.
And have you found in your academic experience that labs in different countries have, I suppose, different cultures around them?
Oh, absolutely. 1,000%. Even two different labs in the same institute would have completely different cultures.
And have any of these cultural differences, I suppose, taken you by surprise or taken effort to get used to?
Yes, but for different reasons, I would say. Okay, my transition from Toronto to Cape Town was going from a basic research lab where, like, every person for themselves into very collaborative research model where we did, you know, these large clinical human cohort studies, which required a lot of collaboration and a lot of communication. And then moving back to Boston, it kind of seemed a little bit similar to the experience in Toronto, but even more so siloed, I would say. You really have to prove yourself by yourself. And then like coming to California, actually, it feels more like Cape Town in the sense that I feel like a lot of people want to work together in teams. And I would say genuinely more open to helping new people integrate, but I feel more supported here.
Do you feel like these differences in levels of collaboration versus competition and things like this, are they kind of decided by the country or more just the individual labs that that one ends up in?
There's like different levels to it. So there's the society that you live in. I think, you know, the stereotype that West Coasters are more relaxed, there is truth to that. Also, there's different levels to where that culture comes from. So my division chief here created the culture very deliberately to be more collegial and collaborative. The competition doesn't really gel well with my personality. It just doesn't feel like it serves me or the science, to be honest. I think it's probably why I felt a little bit out of place in Boston.
Now, there's a lot of discussion about the significance of African researchers moving overseas to carry out their research and also African researchers returning to the continent. How have you thought about this tension in your own career?
Yeah, so this is something I obviously thought about a lot. So I am an African researcher. I was born in Sudan. I still carry a Sudanese passport, but Sudan has not been my lived experience. I haven't lived there myself. So it's a little bit of a confusing place to say I'm going back, you know, to serve my country or to serve my continent when I haven't actually lived there, even though I'm from there. So it was an interesting, I would say, dialectic when I was in Cape Town, because on the one hand, it was very important for me as an African researcher to be represented, to be seen, and to be a role model. But at the same time, I was not from there. You're in this weird place where you're like, well, I'm here because I want to serve this cause of moving African research forward, but I also don't want to perpetuate a colonial global health mentality of coming in with a chip on my shoulder and my, two Canadian degrees on my back and saying, you know, I'm doing something here to help the cause. It's very easy to fall into that ego trap. And I noticed that when I was there. And there are different ways where I can serve the science without having to, quote unquote, be a savior. I don't think I fully resolved the issue. I still feel at my heart and my core, I want to serve African science. I want to see more people who look like me represented in STEM spaces. And I want to do what I need to do, you know, to facilitate that. So like, you know, even if my lab is based in the US, I'm still studying diseases that largely affect the African population. I'm still interested in having trainees come through the lab. But I want to be conscious that I'm still not having that shared lived experience of being there. But ultimately, I have to recognize that I have some privilege being here.
And what privileges does being in the United States actually afford you as a researcher?
Oh, a lot. I think like the grants that usually come into African institutes, I don't want to call them contracts, but, you know, every penny is accounted for. You know, you don't have a lot of leverage to, you know, just take risks and follow your intuition about crazy ideas to pursue. And here, the culture is quite the opposite. It's like, well, what are the ideas that you want to pursue? And you're not necessarily guided by these like top-down decisions of driving the agenda. And so there's a lot more freedom and it's more the attitude towards the science than the science itself. It's slowly changing, but the agenda is still largely driven by the West.
Now, on the flip side, have you faced any disadvantages being a member of the African diaspora in North America, in the United States and Canada?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like all the way from immigration issues to like visa problems and, you know, micro and macro aggressions, racism. You know, I think people tend to undermine what I can bring to the table. or still at this stage, like sometimes treat me like, you know, the young scholar, the junior researcher, the early career person, like, let us mentor you. I think it puts you on the defensive a little bit and sort of like perpetuates even stereotypes that were, you know, the aggressive Black woman and all of that, that when in reality, it's a reaction to constant microaggressions that we feel, that we face actually in the workplace. I think there's a lot more discussion. There's a lot more conversation about these things. And when I call them out now, it's not as left field as it used to be. And there's more conversation around them, but there's still a lot of burden, you know, being one of very few people that look like me in this position.
How do you think we can begin to overcome some of the biggest obstacles that are stopping researchers staying in or stopping researchers returning to the African continent?
Well, we have to discuss if that's the goal in the first place. And I think that's what I'm, you know, always contemplating is my presence there even an advantage? I don't think everybody's goal should be, let's go back. It happens right now that I think I'm in probably the best place to be my best self as a scientist. But, you know, there could easily be other factors that make it easier for me to thrive. You know, for example, I'm far away from my family. That's a big factor in my life, you know, and, you know, although I can cross borders now and get to see them, I've actually gone through years without having access to my family. And that definitely had a huge impact on my mental health and on my productivity as a scientist. And I think the decision to move back has to be backed up by, you know, multiple levels of support. Are you individually supported in your personal life? Are you supported at an institutional level? Are you going into a department that's going to create space for you, help you hire people that serve your mission, allow you to pursue your ideas? Because not every institute actually supports that. You know, sometimes, you know, department heads have specific agendas and they're hiring investigators to support specific research missions. Also, are you in a country where you feel comfortable? You know, can I walk around the streets and feel safe? You know, right now, my home country is pretty much a conflict zone. We haven't had a functioning government since October, since we had the military coup. That's not conducive to doing good research, period. So there's a lot of factors that go into that decision. And it makes a lot more sense to make those big leaps when you actually have real social capital in your career. And when you're in an advanced stage where you can go back and actually affect change. You know, the reality of right now is that there is no place that is home, actually. And home is a feeling that you create wherever you go.
You mentioned in your piece on Scientific African magazine, the role that mentors can play in encouraging young scientists in the African continent. How do we begin to build a better mentorship network then?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think there's I talked about this recently, that the idea that mentors need to look like you is false. And the reality is there's not a lot of senior African researchers, and let me say this very explicitly, senior Black African researchers that we can all look up to and seek support from at this point. So I've had phenomenal mentors that supported me when I was in South Africa that did not look anything like me. They were actually white men, you know, and they've opened so many doors. My career, like I said, I feel like it actually started when I was in Cape Town. So mentorship is huge. Now, what we need is a network of mentors that are both, you know, Black and non-Black. And, you know, we need allies that don't necessarily look like us, but actually have resources to share. And they can be the people who suggest, you know, that we speak in different conferences, put our name forward for different grant opportunities, reviewing, asking us to be a part of their research programs, collaborating. But what's important in those networks is realizing that there is a disadvantage that is specific to people who have come from historically marginalized groups, and not coming in with a position of charity or being a savior or anything like that, but actually acknowledging that course needs to be corrected. There needs to be some sort of reparations, if I can use that word, because a lot of the global health infrastructure started as a colonial project, actually, and we need to be very vocal in acknowledging that, so that real opportunities are given to people who don't have the same historical support.
To what extent do you think that the experiences that you've shared would translate to others who are maybe in a similar position?
The Black diasporan experience is not a monolith. Like, each individual researcher who's a Black diasporan, either because, you know, they're immigrants or because, you know, they came, their ancestors were brought in as slaves, or, migrated a couple of generations ago, as opposed to, you know, migrating now, like, each individual person will have a completely different set of experiences. And we should not talk about these experiences as like one broad umbrella. Just being cognizant that it's a very diverse experience.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sarah Silliman there. It's clear already from the two interviews we've had that every move abroad is felt differently, both in the day-to-day experience and in its cultural significance. But one thing is important for everyone moving to a lab in a new country. Do your research on the team you'll become a part of. You may remember Joanne Cammons, who I spoke to in the first episode of this series. Joanne is a diversity, equity, and inclusion consultant at the Impact Seat. And she says that all the considerations one should make when moving labs are magnified when moving lab abroad.
If you are about to choose a training or postdoc lab, and your and especially for postdocs, your visa is dependent on your PI, it boggles my mind how much people don't realize how important it is that you choose an ethical and supportive PI. The stories of particularly women, but not just women, being, you know, abused, bullied, harassed, taken advantage of by principal investigators who have visa control over people in their lab are horrible. And I would love to see the funding organizations crack down on this type of behavior, as far as overwork, unreasonable requests, bad treatment. But if your visa is dependent on this job, it is very, very hard to make a switch. So it's extremely important for people to carefully choose a lab when they're going to another culture.
So far today, we've explored what it means to set down academic roots in a country far from where you grew up, in terms of both geography and in terms of culture. But for some scientists, a move abroad is more of a temporary step. Psychologist Cushion Zhang is based at Qingdao University in China, the country he grew up in and started his studies. But he got his PhD and worked on his first postdoc in Germany. I spoke to him about what motivated his move, as well as his eventual move back.
I go to Germany in 2011. And I started as a PhD candidate in the University of Constance. And I come back in 2018.
Why did you decide to move to the University of Constance in the first place? What was your motivation?
Because when I was a master student, I had research collaboration with my supervisor in University of Constance. And I do a cross-cultural studies in China for 1 year with the lab based on this. So I saw that it would be a great idea to do a PhD in Germany.
Were you at all nervous about the idea of moving to Germany?
No, I'm not that nervous, because I think that I already know a little bit at least. But actually it might be naive, because so I just as a young guy that, okay, go abroad. But when I started the PhD over there, I really a little bit nervous, because the experience over there, I saw that I still needed too much knowledge to start my PhD.
What kind of knowledge?
Not only language, but also the knowledge from the psychology, as well as more independent life skills, as well as the critical thinking ideas.
What kind of aspects of the lifestyle did you find particularly different to what you were used to?
For example, in China, majority of the students or PhD still can live in the university, and the university can take care of the room. You don't need cooking, you don't need funny apartments, all these type of things. But when I go to Germany, everything you need to take care by yourself, independently. I think that would be, how to say, a little bit shock between China and Germany.
Were there also shocks or differences within the lab in terms of how you would interact with your colleagues or with your supervisor?
Definitely. In the first year, I really had meet problems with my lab mates as well as my supervisors because the different cultural communication method. For example, in China, it is easier for you to direct connect with your supervisor, use your smartphone or send a message. In Germany, it always need to write an email first, fix a time slot for your meeting, and there are huge separation between business and daily life. And the collaboration in Germany, from my perspective at first, it is very independent with each other. That means you need to take care of your own research project independently.
Were there differences that you also found, I suppose, refreshing or enjoyable about your time in Germany?
In the first year, I would say is a tough start because I need to get used how to organize these things in the lab and how to communicate with the colleagues as well as the supervisors. But after 1 year, and you get used the methods over there, is really very enjoyable experience over there because you can take care of your own business as well as you have your own time and own spaces to think freshly, critically by yourself.
How did you find, I suppose, the German society in general?
I studied in University of Konstanz and I live in Konstanz for around 8 years. So in general, the citizens and especially the colleagues in the university are really politely and nice to foreign students.
You've since returned to China, though. What actually made you decide you wanted to go back?
At that time, I already have done 2 year postdoc research for 2 years. So I think that it's my time to start a new level. Looking at the job in China, I think it's not that difficult for me to find a position. And I also already living in Germany for around 8 years. I miss my family and also my country.
Were there, I suppose, lessons or things that you experienced in Germany that you wanted to bring into your lab that you were starting in China?
The first lesson is that to doing independent research, because a great experience in Germany for me is that already thinking independently for the research area and to find your own research interesting.
Do you have any advice for researchers who are thinking about going to study abroad for the first time?
Yeah, I always encourage a lot of my students as well as my colleagues go over abroad, because my main idea is that you definitely need to know the society outside. For the students, for the master students or PhD students, you need to prepare. You have enough language skills as well as enough openness to accept different cultures. That is my tips always for them. The students going abroad, when they come back, they always have a very good connection between China and the society out of China. And I think they are really very good experience for the whole society.
That was Cushion Zhang. As these three interviews have illustrated, moving labs and moving to a new country at the same time can throw up a host of issues and provide a wide range of opportunities. But changing country isn't the only potential complicating factor when moving labs. what happens when you swap labs and transition to a whole different discipline? Well, we'll be discussing exactly that in the next episode. I'll catch you then. This has been Working Scientist, a Nature Careers podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Adam Levy.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.